Picture this. It is just past midnight on the 17th of May, 1943. You are flying an Avro Lancaster bomber at 60 feet above the surface of a German reservoir. The water is a black blur beneath you. Your airspeed reads 220 miles per hour. Your gunners are firing into the dark. Searchlights sweep the hillsides on either side of the valley, and you have to hold that altitude to within a few feet, because if you're off by 20 feet in either direction, the weapon you're carrying will not work the way it needs to. That is not a training scenario. That is the actual mission profile, and the men of Royal Air Force 617 Squadron flew it exactly that way. I'm Tail Dragger, this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we are talking about Operation Chastise, the Dam Busters raid, one of the most precisely executed and audacious attacks in the history of air warfare. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Dam Busters raid did not start with a squadron. It started with a scientist who had an idea that the British Air Ministry initially thought was impractical at best and eccentric at worst. Barnes Wallace was an aeronautical engineer at Vickers. He had helped design the geodesic airframe used in the Wellington bomber, and by the early years of the war, he had turned his considerable mind toward the problem of German industrial capacity, specifically the Ruhr Valley, the industrial heart of the Third Reich. Coal mines, steel mills, munitions factories, chemical plants, all of it depended on electrical power, and much of that power generated by water held behind three massive dams, the Monet Dam, the Eder Dam, the Sorp Dam. Wallace had calculated that destroying those dams would do more damage to German war production than hundreds of conventional bombing raids. The problem was that conventional bombs could not touch them. The Monet Dam alone was over 130 feet tall and 130 feet thick at its base. It held back 134 million tons of water. The Royal Air Force had already tried bombing it from altitude with no meaningful result. Underwater torpedo nets protected the dam face from conventional aerial torpedoes. Wallace had a different approach entirely. He called it the bouncing bomb. The concept drew from an old naval observation. A flat spinning object skips across water rather than sinking immediately. Wallace theorized that a cylindrical bomb spun backwards at a precise speed before release, dropped at an exact altitude and an exact distance from the dam face, would bounce across the surface, clear the torpedo nets, run down the upstream face of the concrete, and sink to the depth where a hydrostatic fuse would trigger the explosion. The shockwave through the water against the dam face would crack the concrete in ways that a direct overhead hit never could. He tested the concept with marbles in a children's bathtub. He tested it with film footage of spheres skipping across a tank of water. And for the better part of 2 years, he fought a determined bureaucratic war against skeptics in the ministry, who told him he was wasting everyone's time. The files of this period are full of politely worded dismissals from men who clearly thought Wallace was somewhere between deluded and tiresome. What changed minds ultimately was the math. Wallace ran the numbers on what breaching those dams would actually cost Germany in industrial output, repair resources, and labor diverted from other construction, and the numbers were persuasive enough that Air Marshal Arthur Harris, the head of Bomber Command, gave the green light in February of 1943. That left 4 months to turn theory into practice. 617 Squadron was formed specifically for Operation Chastise, assembled at Royal Air Force Scampton in Lincolnshire. Crews were drawn from across Bomber Command, selected for experience and precision. They were told it was a special operation. They were not told what they would be attacking. The training began immediately, and it was unusual enough that veterans of dozens of bombing missions found it genuinely unsettling. They flew at night. They flew at low altitude over British reservoirs, Derwent Reservoir in Derbyshire, Eyebrook Reservoir in Leicestershire. The terrain was chosen to match the German targets as closely as available geography allowed, and they practiced the same run, over and over. Come in low over the water. Hold the altitude. Check the instruments. Release on the mark. Pull up hard. Do it again. The altitude problem alone was nearly insurmountable with the equipment available in 1943. Radar altimeters of the era were not precise enough at 60 feet. Barometric altimeters are not usable over water at low altitude. Visual judgment at night over a black reservoir at 220 miles per hour is essentially impossible. Barnes Wallace solved it with spotlights. Two Aldous lamps were fitted beneath each Lancaster's fuselage, angled inward so their beams converged on the water surface at exactly 60 feet. The navigator watched the two circles of light below the aircraft. When they merged into a perfect figure eight on the water, the aircraft was at the correct altitude. The pilot flew on instruments and physical feel, trusting the navigator's calls, keeping his hands steady. And the bomb aimers had their own problem. 425 yards to the dam face, at night, at 220 miles per hour, with anti-aircraft fire coming at them. Barnes Wallace built them a wooden triangular sight with two nails driven in at a calculated distance apart, representing the towers at the ends of the Monet Dam. When the towers aligned with the nails through the sight, the bomb aimer called the release. The airspeed had to read 220 miles per hour. The altitude had to be 60 feet. The distance to the dam had to be 425 yards, all three at once. It sounds almost comically low-tech for what it was attempting. It worked. Wing Commander Guy Gibson commanded 617 Squadron. He was 24 years old and had already flown 89 bombing operations over Germany and 70 night fighter sorties. By any reasonable measure, he should have been removed from operational flying and given something safer. Instead, he volunteered for one more mission. He was quiet, deliberate, demanding of his crews, and by every account he was absolutely unwilling to send a man somewhere he would not go himself. The weapon-designated upkeep weighed approximately 9,500 pounds. Before release, a motor in the aircraft spun it backwards at 500 revolutions per minute. The modified Lancasters had their bomb doors removed entirely to accommodate it. Additional armor plating was added in key locations. The ventral gun turret was deleted to save weight. Every unnecessary pound was stripped from the aircraft to compensate for what they were carrying. On the night of May 16, 1943, 19 Lancaster bombers lifted off from Scampton in three waves. They crossed the North Sea at low altitude, under radar coverage, and flew into Germany in the darkness. Low enough in several documented accounts to clip telephone lines with their propeller wash. Low enough that gunners reported seeing German cattle startle in fields as they passed. Gibson led the first wave of 9 aircraft against the Monet Dam. The approach ran along the length of the reservoir, between hills rising on either side, then out over the open water to the dam face. Anti-aircraft guns were positioned on the dam towers and on the surrounding hillsides. The Lancasters had to hold their altitude through the fire, hold their speed, hold their heading, and not flinch. Gibson attacked first. His upkeep released cleanly, bounced across the surface, and detonated against the dam face. The structure held. Flight Lieutenant John Hopgood attacked second. His Lancaster had already taken flak damage on the inbound leg. He was wounded. He flew his run anyway. His bomb was released a fraction of a second late, bounced over the crest of the dam, and detonated on the powerhouse on the far side of the structure. His aircraft was burning as he pulled away from the dam. He ordered his crew to bail out. He brought the aircraft low enough for four of them to jump before it struck the ground. Hopgood was 21 years old. What Gibson did next was not in any operational order anyone had given him. After delivering his own weapon on the first pass, he stayed in the target area at low altitude, flying alongside each subsequent attacking Lancaster with his navigation lights switched on, drawing flak fire away from the bomber making its run. He had already dropped his weapon. He had no tactical need to be there. He simply did not want his crews to face that approach alone on the fifth attack. Flight Lieutenant Mickey Martin's weapon hit, then a sixth. Then on the seventh run, Pilot Officer Les Knight's bomb detonated against the already weakened concrete, and the Monet gave way. A column of water and debris erupted into the night sky that the crews could see from miles away. A wave 25 feet high began moving down the Ruhr Valley. Gibson took the remaining aircraft to the Eder Dam. The approach there was more demanding. The reservoir was enclosed by steep hills. The attack run required a steep diving turn just to line up at the correct altitude, with barely enough room to complete the approach before reaching the dam face. It was the kind of geometry that no reasonable Czech airman would sign off on in daylight, let alone in the dark. It took three passes before Les Knight breached the Eder. Two dams, broken on a single night. The Sorp Dam, the third primary target, was an earthen structure rather than concrete. The physics of the upkeep bomb did not translate to an earthen construction. The aircraft that reached the Sorp damaged its crest but could not breach it. 8 of the 19 Lancasters did not come home. 53 airmen were killed, 3 were taken prisoner. The youngest men on those crews were barely old enough to vote back in England. Flight Sergeant Ken Brown, 19 years old, flew the Sorp attack and came home alone after the rest of his wave had been lost. The flooding downstream of the Monet and Eder dams was catastrophic for the Ruhr Valley. Factories were damaged. Mines were flooded. Power generation was disrupted across the region. Roads and bridges were swept away over a wide area. The German repair effort consumed tens of thousands of workers and enormous quantities of material throughout that summer, pulling all of it away from other projects, including the fortifications along the Atlantic coast. There is a part of this story that deserves to be stated plainly. Approximately 1,600 people died in the flooding. Many of them were Ukrainian. Forced laborers held in camps along the river valley below the dams. They were prisoners. They did not choose to be there. That does not diminish what 617 Squadron accomplished or the courage of every man who flew that night. But it is part of what happened, and it belongs in the telling. Guy Gibson was awarded the Victoria Cross. 32 others received decorations. Gibson was killed in September of 1944 on a separate operation. He was 26 years old. Barnes Wallace kept going. He developed the Tallboy bomb, 12,000 pounds, designed to penetrate deep underground before detonating and create an earthquake effect beneath hardened structures. And then the Grand Slam, 22,000 pounds, the largest bomb deployed by any nation during the Second World War. Both weapons were delivered by 617 Squadron against targets conventional bombing could not reach. The German battleship Tirpitz hidden in a Norwegian fjord, the reinforced bunkers housing the V-weapons in France, the Saumur railway tunnel in the Loire Valley. 617 Squadron became the Royal Air Force's precision instrument deployed when the target was too important and too hardened for ordinary methods. Barnes Wallace said in later years that he felt personally responsible for every man lost on Operation Chastise. He visited families. He contributed to the education of children who grew up without fathers. He carried the accounting of that night for the rest of his life, even as he understood the strategic necessity of what he had helped create. The 1955 film The Dam Busters, with Eric Coates' March, introduced Operation Chastise to an entire generation that had not lived through it. That piece of music still raises the hair on the back of your neck if you know what it represents. It sounds like low altitude and spinning bombs and 19 aircraft lifting off into the dark. Pull up a chair and sit with this for a moment, 60 feet at night, 220 miles per hour, watching two spotlights merge on the water beneath you, holding your heading through the fire, pressing the run because the crews behind you are depending on what you do in the next 15 seconds. The math worked, the bomb worked, and the dam broke. Sources for this segment include James Holland's Dam Busters and John Sweetman's The Dam Busters Raid. More stories at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger, Blue Side Up.